Lucas on Life.
Hello, welcome to Lucas on Life. I'm Jeff Lucas, and you're listening to Premier Christian Radio. Happy Sunday, and thanks so much for joining me. I've been pondering the so-called rapidly changing world. Has anybody noticed how much the media and politicians are constantly describing things in that way? And I've been noticing that name-calling is becoming more and more aggressive. When the journalist Jeffrey Goldberg published a bombshell story outlining how some of the most senior US officials had mistakenly shared sensitive information with him, he obtained the biggest scoop of the year. But it's been bruising, at least for him, ever since, because in recent weeks, the Atlantic editor has been called a loser and a sleazebag by President Trump, as well as a liar and scum by US National Security Advisor Michael Waltz, who appeared to have mistakenly added Goldberg to a group chat earlier, just a few weeks ago. Now, the political arena has always been a place of fierce argument and fast retort. Sir Winston Churchill, rightly celebrated for oratory that galvanised the nation at war, he knew the power of an acidic sentence. I wish Stanley Baldwin no ill, but it would have been much better if he had never lived, Churchill said in 1946. And then he called Labour leader Ramsay MacDonald a sheep in sheep's clothing. On Prime Minister Clement Attlee, Winston Churchill said, "There is less there than meets the eye." But it seems to me that recent vitriol and name-calling has taken new depths. All of this, I think, is rather worrying, not least because of instead of debating issues, leaders resort to infantile barbs more commonly found in the school playground. Maybe that's an insult to the school playground, but then younger souls who are still in the playground may well feel more empowered to send bullying tweets when adults in high office resort to consistent verbal abuse. And then we Christians are not exempt from this, as just scanning social media proves. Someone poses an honest question about theology, and the quick retort is that they are now a heretic just for asking the question. Or maybe a Christian leader dismisses an honest question from a member of their congregation. They've asked it with the best intention, but now suddenly there's some name-calling as they're dubbed as being divisive. The way we talk, especially when we disagree, it really matters. So, after this, let's talk a little more about the way we talk. Let's talk about straight talk. All right, so my passport photograph, it really isn't the best. Actually, it's really quite scary. I'm not sure what I was thinking when I popped behind the green curtains in that photograph booth in the now defunct Woolworths. I fed my pound coins in and then glared like a trainee serial killer into the glass square that housed the camera. Why did I pull that facial expression, one that inmates on death row usually pull before they meet the hooded executioner? Was I battling some angst about faith, or maybe wrestling with the internal consequences of an earlier chicken Madras? My picture, it was not so much of a pose, more of a confrontation. I'm not saying that the result is ugly, but if you have problems getting your kids to go to bed at night, call me and I'll send over the photo, because they'll dash under the covers at the speed of light, tearfully thankful to be away from that scary man in the photo. There isn't an airbrush powerful enough to turn my little snap into something warm and attractive. But I was unprepared for the reaction that I received at passport control at London Heathrow recently. I was feeling relieved to actually be out of the queue, because it seemed like half of the world was trying to get into the UK and there were only two border control inspectors to manage things. Those really helpful machines they have now, they weren't being that helpful because they weren't working. A kindly looking chap held out his hand for my passport. Bless him, he had no idea of the horror that his eyes were about to alight upon when he flipped open my passport and the unsmiling face of a psychopath stared back at him. He was unable to control himself. "My goodness," he exclaimed, visibly shocked. And then there was a terrible moment of embarrassment as he dug an even deeper hole. "And you're so much younger than me as well," he added. Then he realised that he'd just allowed some fairly offensive words to tumble out of his mouth, and his look of horror widened. Maybe I was now a mortally offended serial killer, aging badly but good with an axe. Perhaps wisely, he said no more. We often celebrate the virtue of blunt talk and count as worthy the person who calls a spade, which is good because even in post-modernity, a spade isn't a fish. And Jesus was blunt with the religiously smug as he sought to wake them from the cloying sleep that self-righteousness brings. The Apostle Paul, he was a straight shooter as well, advising the Galatians who were bringing circumcision back into fashion to go the whole hog and just castrate themselves. Not exactly warm, comforting pastoral chat. He was blunt and he took risks with it. To confront pious legalism means that the challenger always seems more like a liberal than a freedom fighter. Grace is always most amazing and sometimes incomprehensible to the religious zealot. Sometimes bluntness and thoughtlessness are married. Far from being premeditated, there's been no meditation. I'm sure that one lady who strolled up to me post-sermon and asked me if I'd ever had a stroke, she was really quite innocent. I replied in the negative, silently wondered if she had any interest in surveying the surgical scars that I do have, and then asked her why she thought I was a stroke victim. "Well, Jeff, it's just that when you smile, only one side of your face goes up," she said. I would have smiled back at her generously, but apparently the smile would have been wonky. Now, surely there was no malice in her question. Insensitivity was her only crime, and I decided to not be offended despite the fact that my own father had suffered a terrible stroke that stole one of his greatest joys, talking. She was not to know any of that, but I fear that sometimes arrogance crouches behind bluntness. So confident are we that the first notion that pops into our head must be right, we share it, uncensored by pause or reflection, and then we wonder at the damage our blunt talk causes. Of course, for some, that's just the point, to damage. They bully, pummel and jab with words, and when in doubt, they shout louder, victory by bluster and blasts of searing hot air. But there's nothing commendable or clever about being a verbal pit bull. Because we're good with words doesn't mean that we're always good. As we're thinking about the way we talk, let's also think about the way we write, especially those emails. The anonymous letter is a frequently used communication technique, believe it or not, in some churches. Disgruntled and offended parishioners express their irritations to pastors and leaders by dispatching an unsigned epistle. The lack of signature and therefore the hidden identity of the writer gives them the courage needed to put the most toxic poison on paper. Scurrilous accusations, inferences and innuendos jostle with each other in the grubby scrawl. The net effect on the recipient is devastating. It's like being hit by a relational exocet that comes screaming in from the dark, demolishing in a few seconds your confidence, your sense of calling and hope. Now, emails, well, there's one benefit to them, and that is you can't send them anonymously. But many years ago, before they were even ever thought of, the famous evangelist D.L. Moody received such a poisonous pen letter while actually preaching a sermon. Someone out there in the congregation was apparently feeling highly uncomfortable and maybe challenged, and so they hastily scratched out a note and passed it back to an usher who calmly walked up to the pulpit. The folded note had Mr. Moody's name written on it, reasoned the hapless usher, and so Mr. Moody should receive the note immediately, even though he was in the middle of his sermon. Moody took the note, unfolded it carefully, and read its brief content. One word was written on the page. Just the word fool. Moody sighed, refolded the note and made an announcement. I've just been sent a most unusual letter from one of you in the congregation, he said to a fairly shocked crowd. Now this is most interesting, he continued. I'm often sent letters where people write the body of the letter, but they just omit their name. On this occasion, in writing the single word fool, the person concerned has omitted to write the letter itself and has only signed their name. He then got on with his sermon. I saw the power of the anonymous letter while my wife Kay and I were working on the staff of a church in Oregon. Having been a well-received part of the team for some 18 months or so, we'd felt that it was time to move on to a wider ministry of itinerant Bible teaching. An announcement was made to the church advising them of our resignation and imminent departure. The letter was sent to the senior minister and to all of the deacons, but of course Kay and I were not sent a copy by the anonymous writer. The letter alleged that the senior minister was jealous of the warm welcome that Kay and I had been shown and that he was nervous that we were popular and so had acted to force us to leave. We were, the letter declared with the authority of one that knew, we were being driven out of town. The senior minister felt a high level of anxiety at this scandalous and totally untrue suggestion, so I asked him to allow me to deal with the problem in my own way. He agreed. It was our final Sunday in the church. It was my leaving service, and I was preaching my last sermon. The place was packed. It was time for what I hoped would be some redemptive fun. Now, before I conclude, I said, I want you to know that the senior minister and the deacons of this church have each been sent a copy of a letter without a signature, which accuses them of treating Kay and me badly and suggesting that we are, and I quote, being driven out of town. I paused, looked around. Tension crackled in the air, and I looked around at John, the senior minister, who shifted from side to side on his seat on the platform, and I continued. I've decided to tell you the unedited truth about the senior minister of this church and the deacon board too. Hey, it's my last Sunday here and I've got nothing to lose. I currently have the microphone in hand, so why don't I just go ahead and spill the beans, as it were, on these people? The level of tension rose even higher and, perhaps a bit naughtily, I decided to milk the moment. I walked back away from the pulpit and stood beside John. Placing my hand on his shoulder, I said, "Now let me just tell you the unbridled truth about this man. Again, what have I got to lose? So let's just go for broke." John looked up at me with pleading eyes, sweat breaking out now on his forehead. I had to wrap this up, if only to put poor John out of his ministry. And so I continued, "This man, John, he's done nothing, and I say again, nothing, but bless, shower kindness, encouragement, and help upon me, my family, and my ministry. He and the deacons of this church have done absolutely everything in their power to help resource and release me. I owe them a great debt. And so, to whomever it was that wrote the anonymous letter suggesting some kind of ridiculous conspiracy, I'd like to say two things. First, check your facts, because you couldn't be more wrong. And then second, next time you sit down to put pen to paper, have the moral courage to sign your name at the bottom of the letter. An unsigned letter is not worthy of the time needed to read it. It's a work of cowardice. Whoever wrote it, please hear me say this loud and clear. You need to repent." I sat down, and the congregation rose to their feet in what was not a standing ovation for me, but an affirming message of love and endorsement for John and the team of deacons that had faithfully served with him. I looked at the crowd, hooping and yelling and waving their Bibles and clapping and cheering, and I realized that someone, somewhere out there in the crowd, was the author of that anonymous letter. Let's be careful about what we say. Let's be careful about what we write. As we've been thinking about the way we talk, what we say, how we write, It's not only the content of our message that matters, but when it comes to speaking, the tone of our message is important too. You see, Christians are passionate people, and sometimes passionate people can sound strident and aggressive. And there's also a temptation to be angry when we feel that our viewpoint is being suppressed. And when that happens, we can come across as ranting, yelling people who are regarded as suspicious. We're called to persuade, not pummel people with our words. Sometimes the world can't hear a word of what we're saying because they're too put off by the way that we say it. It was a wonder that Jesus spent so much time in the company of the despised sinners of his day, but an even greater miracle that they wanted to spend time with him. The holiest person who has ever walked the earth was a sought-after party guest and the kind of person that children lined up to hug, not usually a problem for wide-eyed fanatical types. His winsome storytelling nudged people to think and discover truth. His preaching didn't involve blasting people with right ideas, but edged them forward to discovery. So, let's be willing to break step with our shouting world, with all the name-calling, with all of the vitriol, and have the courage of our convictions, but be kind as we express them. That's how we should talk. See you next week. Lucas on Life.